morning, Africa, and welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington. Today is Tuesday, February the 15th, and here are some of the stories that we're covering for you this morning. Parts of Malawi are still recovering from January's tropical storm Anna, which left scores dead across Madagascar, Malawi, Mozambique, and Zimbabwe.
We are mobilizing additional funds from existing resources, but we're also trying to raise funds with donors now, highlighting the importance of bringing help to the families in need here in Malawi.
That is Rudolf Schwenk. He's the acting UN representative to Malawi. In Nigeria, the academic staff of universities is warning the government of plans to embark on a nationwide strike to press home its demands.
We had an agreement with the federal government about 13 years ago, and on a number of issues that had to do with funding of universities, but up to now, a number of the issues there have not been implemented.
That is Professor Emmanuel Osedeke, the president of the academic staff of universities. And how do you get more African youth into farming? We'll speak to a Kenyan entrepreneur behind Tukalime, an agribusiness venture. We'll have those stories and more coming up right here on Daybreak Africa. Stay tuned. In Nigeria, the academic staff of universities, ASUU, is warning the government of plans to embark on a nationwide strike to press home its demands. The group issued a one-month warning following a two-day meeting by its National Executive Council. Their key demands include the revitalization of all public universities, increased funding of state universities, and the payment of promotion arrears and allowances. But analysts said the decision to embark on the strike could draw a backlash from the government. The Minister for Labour, Employment and Productivity, Chris Ngige, has warned that he will not allow members of the association to embark on a strike action. Professor Emmanuel Osodeke is the president of the academic staff of universities. He tells VOA's Peter Claudi that the planned strike is part of an effort to pressure the government to fund education.
We had an agreement with the federal government about 13 years ago, and on a number of issues that had to do with funding of universities, autonomy of universities, and the welfare of the member, which is salary. But up to now, a number of issues there have not been implemented. We are also going to strike a number of times to get them to implement them, and they will make promise and sign an agreement, memorandum of understanding, but they still will not implement. And that is why we have tried to give them that 1 month notice of the strike, hoping that within this 1 month they will resolve all the issues.
Well, Prof, some people are suggesting that this is not a time to ask or pressure the government to meet your demands, especially when the economy has been battered by the ongoing coronavirus pandemic that has significantly impacted the Nigerian economy. How do you respond to that?
This economy you talked about, did it affect their foreign trips with absolutely nothing to do outside? Has it affected what they take as allowances? Has it affected the running of their units, such as the National Assembly and what have you? Has it affected them? They actually increased. Actually, don't you recall, just a month ago, the president of this country increased the duty to allowance, the money they spend in travel, he doubled it. So if you can double what they spend to travel all over the world, why can't you also invest some money in education? But recall that any of these countries doing well, because they invest up to 50 to 20% of their budget on education. I think it's between 6 and 5. So the argument doesn't make sense. That's why we are saying that, look, if we must develop as a country, we have to invest in education.
The Minister of Labour, Employment and Productivity, Chris Ngige, recently vowed not to allow the lecturers to go on strike again. Are you not on a coalition course with him?
Well, he has the right to say he will not, but we also have a right as a union to determine what we want to do. We are not slaves. It's only when you have a slave and a master, the master can say we cannot do whatever. We are not slaves. And I don't think all over the world, staff, lecturers, unions, they do go on strike. So they do whatever they want to do. If you want to close down the universities, you can go ahead and close down the universities.
Well, Professor Osodeke, is there a chance where there will be an engagement between the National Executive Council of the Academic Staff Union of Universities and the government to resolve some of these concerns? Because some people are suggesting that it is the students who will be most affected by the strike.
People we are qualified doing this trouble for are the students. When you come to a typical Nigerian university, you will not see a single foreign student because of the system. No practical, no equipment for practicals, no equipment, no laboratories, and what have you. Well, is there any university you go to the United States where you are, you will not see foreign students, you will not see Nigerians, you will not spoil about the world? Why is Nigeria different? Because it's not fully funded. That is why we are fighting for the children. We are not fighting for ourselves. Because we are in Nigeria, where in those days, in the 70s and early 80s, you see, when you enter a typical class like Nigeria, you see students from all over the world. You see lecturers from all over the world. Today, would you enter Nigeria University and see a foreign lecturer? Similarly, is there any university you enter in the United States and you not see a foreign Nigeria and foreign lecturer in them? We don't want Nigeria University to be killed. And it's great to realize that APA should bring that struggle.
Professor Emmanuel Osedeke is the president of the academic staff of universities in Nigeria. He was speaking to VOA's Peter Clotty. Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, or IPCC, has begun a two-week meeting to consider a report that assesses the impact of the world's changing climate and how humans may adapt. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
Hundreds of scientists meeting virtually will lay out the latest evidence on how past and future changes to the Earth's climate system are affecting the planet. The report under review is the second of three installments that will comprise the IPCC's sixth assessment report, which will be released later this year. In August, the scientific body approved the first contribution of Working Group 1, which dealt with the physical science basis of climate change. The second part, currently under review, highlights the role of social justice and diverse forms of knowledge, such as indigenous and local knowledge, might play to strengthen climate change action and reduce the risks. The chair of the IPCC, Ho-Sung Lee, says the report focuses on solutions and productive areas for action.
It will be more strongly integrate the natural, social, and economic sciences. And it will provide policymakers with sound data and knowledge to help them shape policies and make decisions. The need for the Working Group 2 report has never been greater because the stakes have never been higher.
The United Nations-backed IPCC was established in 1988 to provide political leaders with periodic scientific assessments regarding climate change. The panel previously issued five assessment reports that spotlighted climate change as an issue of growing global importance. The Paris Agreement on Climate Change calls for limiting human-induced global warming to well below 2 degrees Celsius, preferably 1.5 degrees Celsius, above pre-industrial levels. The IPCC warns that mark will be exceeded this century unless drastic action is taken. Secretary General of the World Meteorological Organization, Petteri Talas, says weather-related disasters have been increasing dramatically over the past two decades. He says vulnerable areas in tropical latitudes, especially in Africa, Southern Asia, and the Pacific, are suffering the worst impacts of climate-driven disasters. He says he often uses a sports analogy to communicate the seriousness of climate change to humanity.
We have at the moment the Winter Olympics going on in China. We have high-performing athletes, and if you give them doping, then they perform even more effectively. So that's what we have done to the atmosphere. We have been doping the atmosphere.
The contribution by Working Group 3 dealing with the mitigation of climate change will be finalized in April. The concluding synthesis of IPCC's sixth assessment report will be made in September. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Controversial South African politician Julius Malema was back in court earlier this month, accused of inciting hatred against white farmers. The AfriForum NGO says the leader of the country's third largest political party, the Economic Freedom Fighters, or the EFF, continues to sing a song calling for white farmers to be shot dead. Malema was found guilty in 2010 of hate speech for singing the song when he was president of the African National Congress Youth League. Darren Taylor has more.
Kiss the poor, the farmer, the Since his conviction and fine 11 years ago, Malema has changed the lyrics of the song from Kill the Farmer to Kiss the Farmer. But he continues to sing Shoot to Kill, gesturing as if he's holding a firearm. AfriForum says the song advocates hatred on the grounds of race and ethnicity and is an incitement to cause harm. The group's policy head, Ernst Rutz, has told the Equality Court that racial hatred, partly inspired by songs like Kiss the Farmer, is evident in the torture involved in a lot of farm attacks.
The most common forms of physical torture that occur during the commitment of the farm attack include beatings, stabbings, burning victims with boiling water, molten plastic, and hot clothes irons. Some farmers are even slaughtered like animals or dragged behind their own vehicles. They are tied to the vehicle with a rope and then dragged for vast distances.
According to former police colonel Johan Berger, now a crime expert at the Institute for Security Studies, 1,242 white farmers were murdered between 1990 and 2020. AfriForum says a conservative estimate of white farmers killed since South Africa became a democracy in 1994 is 4,000, with many more thousands, including their wives and children, brutalized. The government maintains farm attacks are part of a broader crime crisis and are not racially motivated. Rutz testified this is contradicted by many perpetrators who've been found guilty of killings on farms.
When Knowledge Polis Mandlazi was charged for committing 5 farm murders, he responded in court that he had murdered these people because he wanted their money. He added that, and I quote, "My hate for white people made me do it." And he said that he regarded murdering white people as merely going to work.
The police say robbery is the main motive behind almost 90% of farm attacks. Rutz agrees that stealing may indeed be the primary motive, but he told the court it isn't the only driver.
So if you simply go there to steal, why do you spend hours, several hours on a farm? There's even been cases of perpetrators taking a break from the torturing to eat lunch and then go back to the torture. Oftentimes they can steal because there's nobody at the house, but then they wait for the people to come back and then they ambush them when they arrive at the house and they murder them.
Malema says he's got nothing to do with farm murders. He says more black people are killed in South Africa in a single day than the number of white farmers murdered during an entire year. In an affidavit before court, the EFF leader says it's ridiculous that a song called Kiss the Farmer can be considered incitement to harm anyone. He says his song is merely encouraging black citizens to fight legitimately for land that's rightfully theirs. Malema has said on national TV that most of the country's wealth and land still belong to whites and that they should learn to share. If they don't, he said, there'd be trouble, but that the time wasn't right for them to be attacked yet.
I wouldn't know what will happen in the future, but I'm saying let there be a peaceful transfer of land without any drop of blood. I don't want to see any drop of blood. And white people are more than safe under Julius Malema, under the EFF. Racists are not safe. The white supremacists are not safe.
Malema remains in full voice. That could change sometime next week when the court ruling's expected to be given. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm Jackson Vunganyi. In Senegal, separatist rebels on Monday released 7 Senegalese soldiers they captured last month following negotiations involving the West African regional bloc ECOWAS. The soldiers, who were part of a West African force in neighboring Gambia, were taken captive by rebels from the Movement of Democratic Forces for Casamance during a clash that also killed at least 2 Senegalese troops and 1 rebel fighter. In Sudan, reports said at least two protesters were shot dead as security forces confronted crowds marching in the capital, Khartoum. Thousands of protesters returned to the streets in the capital and across Sudan in some of the biggest demonstrations against the October coup in nearly a month. Across the River Nile from Khartoum, officers fired tear gas to try to disperse people who approached the disused parliament building in Omdurman and got close to a key bridge. Protesters are demanding the release of prisoners and an end to military rule. Voice of America. Parts of Malawi are still recovering from January's tropical storm Anna, which left scores dead across Madagascar, Malawi, Mozambique, and Zimbabwe. UN agencies in Malawi have been providing help to displaced people in camps, but those affected say thousands more need shelter, food, and clean water. Lamek Masina reports from Sanje in Malawi.
Hannah Gift fled her home to the Bangula evacuation camp in late January after floods from Tropical Storm Anna washed away all her property and livestock. But the single mother of four says the situation in the camp is awful. She says life in the camp is unbearable. We are only given one cup of maize flour per family, she says, adding that they sometimes go to sleep without eating. Flood victim Selenia Gazrina says there is no way to earn money. She says they have nowhere to go to earn money or buy their own food. All the gardens here have been washed away, she says, so no one can offer us work in their gardens. Gazrina and Gift are among nearly 1 million Malawians affected by floods in more than half of the country's 28 districts. 33 people were killed in the floods. UN agencies in Malawi and donors have started providing aid to victims, but say additional funds are needed. Rudolf Schwenk is acting UN resident coordinator in Malawi and also the UNICEF country representative.
Well, as UNICEF, we had mobilized around $500,000, so $500,000 already pre-positioned and procured supplies, because obviously we had planned for disasters, so we were able to utilize that. Of course, we are mobilizing additional funds from existing resources, but we're also trying to raise funds with donors now, highlighting the importance of bringing help to the families in need here in Malawi.
Malawi lost a third of its electric generating capacity when the storm damaged a hydropower station. Environmental experts blame climate change, deforestation, and soil degradation for making the floods worse. Paul Turnbull is the country representative for the World Food Programme in Malawi.
Now that there's been so much of the forest cover has been taken away, the only solution really is to go and rehabilitate those hillsides. So we call it watershed management, and there are very, very clear techniques to make sure that the damage that happens when you've got very heavy rainfall is reduced. You dig trenches, you plant trees, you terrace the land, you use the right crops at the right time.
Meanwhile, Malawi's weather experts warn more flooding is possible in the northern and central parts of the country as heavy rain is expected over the weekend. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Nsanje, Malawi.
The United Nations estimates that by 2050, the world's population will grow to around 2.2 billion people, more than half of which will come from Africa. However, the continent continues to struggle to feed its people, even as it sits on over 200 million hectares of unused fertile land. Researchers say that Africa needs to increase its food production by 60% over the next 15 years for it to be able to feed its growing population. But for this to happen, the continent, of which the majority is under 25 years of age, must find innovative ways to make agriculture attractive to young people. Studies show that many youth in developing countries have negative perceptions of farming, which is one of the reasons that Africa has become a net importer of food and the largest recipient of food aid in the world. Kevin Kamau is a young Kenyan entrepreneur and farmer, and through his organization Tukalime, which is Swahili for Let Us Farm, an agribusiness company that offers farm management, hopes to change that negative perception by encouraging more young people to become farmers. He joins me from Nairobi, and I start off by asking him the inspiration behind him joining farming.
To be honest, it wasn't by design to start farming. I was living in the US for about 10 years. Then I moved back here. And the first thing was trying to get a job. And the funny thing is, you know, you always have those uncles and aunties telling you, could you please give me your resume, your CV, let me shop it around, move back and stuff. And then when you move back, these guys cannot be found. So what happened was I met a gentleman that was farming, and I just started just riding with him in this car and going to the farms and stuff. And we started our own farms. So he had been laid off. So when he got a job, because he was job hunting, I was left by myself. However, my friends in the diaspora, mostly in the US, were like, hey, you've been farming and we have a problem because we keep sending money back home, but mom and dad do not have the strength to keep on traveling and supervising the works at the farm. Do you mind extending your services to cover our farms? That's how we started.
Now, Kevin, the narrative on the continent is that a farmer is someone in the rural areas who can barely make ends meet, and that students should never aspire to that kind of lifestyle. What attracted you to farming, and how do you change that narrative for other young people on the continent?
When we were growing up, we were told if you don't go to school, you become a farmer. And the teachers, I don't know if it's through a fault of their own or just the way society was set up, they basically stigmatized farming and made people feel like if you were farming, it was about poverty, like you were back, you know, you were destitute. And so there's a rebellious thing in me that was like, no, we can do this, because in Africa, for those who live in Africa, in Kenya and everywhere else, you get to see most of our leadership or most of the most wealthiest people in this continent primarily are farmers. Most of them lead industry in terms of farming, in terms of manufacturing, where they've invested in the agricultural sector. So for me, it was a thing to change that narrative and to show people that actually you can make a living and still go on vacations and still live a very nice urban life. But farming is a humble and rewarding occupation that you can take on.
And how do you become a farmer? What is the entry point? What are some of the basic things that you need to become a farmer? Is it simply a piece of land and some seeds?
Not necessarily. I mean, that's the beginning. The first thing you have to do is, I keep telling people there are two types of farming, you know, the romantic side of farming and the commercial side of farming. The romantic side of farming is when you go out there to the farm and take pictures and post on Instagram and say, hey, look at me, I'm in the countryside and life is good. Then there's a commercial side of farming where you have to make sure that the inputs in terms of land, labor, and capital, so basically the factors of production, are working in your favor to make a profit. So it's not only land and seeds. You know, you need to look at is you know, the first thing we usually start with is when you do your soil analysis, what does my soil have? Has it been overused? Do I need to add fertilizer into the soil to make sure it's productive? Is there enough water to make sure that my crops are going to survive? And most importantly, what's my route to market? Where am I going to sell this ware? Especially if you do not have that route to market, then you're kind of in a losing game, you know? So there are very many parts to it, you have to, in anything that you do, you have to draw it out.
That was Kevin Kamau. He's the founder and CEO of Tukalime, an agribusiness company based in Kenya. For more of our conversation with Kevin Kamau, tune in to VOA's Upfront Show on Wednesday at 17:30 and 21:30 UTC. And that's it for this edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this morning with us. For more African news and features, visit our website at voanews.com. Remember to connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Twitter. We are also on Instagram and Facebook. Just search for VOA Africa. For now, I'm Jackson Vunganyi in Washington, wishing you a great day ahead, Africa.